Side 2. Her date had taken her to a cellar bar off Kenmore Square. Jesse was singing rhythm and blues and playing lead guitar. The way he sang and the way he moved made clear what she had been missing. The next night she returned alone. She seated herself at the nearest table and locked eyes with him through both his sets. 2 months later, they were living together. It was only when his bookings took him to Hartford or Bangor that she got any work done at all. She would spend her days with the other students, boys with the final generation of slide rules hanging like trophies from their belts, boys with plastic pencil holders in their breast pockets, precise, stilted boys with nervous laughs, serious boys, spending all their waking moments becoming scientists. Absorbed in training themselves to plumb the depths of nature, they were almost helpless in ordinary human affairs, where, for all their knowledge, they seemed pathetic and shallow. Perhaps the dedicated pursuit of science was so consuming, so competitive, that no time was left to become a well-rounded human being. Or perhaps their social disabilities had led them to fields where the want would not be noticed. Except for science itself. She did not find them good company. At night there was Jesse, leaping and wailing, a kind of force of nature that had taken over her life. In the year they spent together, she could not recall a single night when he proposed they go to sleep. He knew nothing of physics or mathematics, but he was wide awake inside the universe. And for a time, so was she. She dreamed of reconciling her two worlds. She had fantasies of musicians and physicists in harmonious social concert. But the evenings she organized were awkward and ended early. One day he told her he wanted a baby. He would be serious, he'd settle down, he'd get a regular job. He might even consider marriage. A baby? She asked him. But I'd have to leave school. I have years more before I'm done. If I had a baby, I might never go back to school. Yeah, he said. But we'd have a baby. You wouldn't have school, but you'd have something else. Jesse, I need school, she told him. He shrugged, and she could feel their lives together slip off his shoulders and away. It lasted another few months, but it all had really been settled in that brief exchange. They kissed each other goodbye, and he went off to California. She never heard his voice again. In the late 1960s, the Soviet Union succeeded in landing space vehicles on the surface of Venus. They were the first spacecraft of the human species to set down in working order on another planet. Over a decade earlier, American radio astronomers confined to Earth had discovered that Venus was an intense source of radio emission. The most popular explanation had been that the massive atmosphere of Venus trapped the heat through a planetary greenhouse effect. In this view, the surface of the planet was stifling hot, much too hot for crystal cities and wandering Venusians. Ellie longed for some other explanation, and tried unsuccessfully to imagine ways in which the radio emission could come from high above a clement Venus surface. Some astronomers at Harvard and MIT claimed that none of the alternatives to a broiling Venus could explain the radio data. The idea of so massive a greenhouse effect seemed to her unlikely. And somehow distasteful, a planet that had let itself go. But when the Venera spacecraft landed, and in effect stuck out a thermometer, the temperature measured was high enough to melt tin or lead. She imagined the crystal cities liquefying, although Venus wasn't quite that hot. The surface awash in silicate tears. She was a romantic. She had known it for years. But at the same time, she had to admire how powerful radio astronomy was. The astronomers had sat home, pointed their radio telescopes at Venus, and measured the surface temperature just about as accurately as the Venera probes did 13 years later. She had been fascinated with electricity and electronics as long as she could remember, but this was the first time she had been deeply impressed by radio astronomy. You stay safely on your own planet and point your telescope with its associated electronics. Information about other worlds then comes fluttering down through the feeds. She marveled at the notion. Kelly began to visit the university's modest radio telescope in nearby Harvard, Massachusetts, eventually getting an invitation to help with the observations and the data analysis. She was accepted as a paid summer assistant at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Greenbank, West Virginia, and upon arrival, gazed in some rapture at Grote Reber's original radio telescope, constructed in his backyard in Wheaton, Illinois in 1938, and now serving as a reminder of what a dedicated amateur can accomplish. Reber had been able to detect the radio emission from the center of the galaxy when no one nearby happened to be starting up the car, and the diathermy machine down the street was not in operation. The galactic center was much more powerful, but the diathermy machine was a lot closer. The atmosphere of patient inquiry and the occasional rewards of modest discovery were agreeable to her. They were trying to measure how the number of distant extragalactic radio sources increased as they looked deeper into space. She began to think about better ways of detecting faint radio signals. In due course, she graduated cum laude from Harvard and went on for graduate work in radio astronomy at the other end of the country, at the California Institute of Technology. For a year, she apprenticed herself to David Drumlin. He had a worldwide reputation for brilliance and for not suffering fools gladly, but was at heart one of those men you can find at the top of every profession who are in a state of unrelieved anxiety that someone somewhere might prove smarter than they. Drumlin taught Ellie some of the real heart of the subject, especially its theoretical underpinnings. Although he was inexplicably rumored to be attractive to women, Ellie found him frequently combative and unremittingly self-involved. She was too romantic, he would say. The universe is strictly ordered according to its own rules. The idea is to think as the universe does, not to foist our romantic predispositions and girlish longings, he once said, on the universe. Everything not forbidden by the laws of nature, he assured her, quoting a colleague down the hall, is mandatory. But, he went on, almost everything is forbidden. She gazed at him as he lectured, trying to divine this odd combination of personality traits. She saw a man in excellent physical condition, prematurely gray hair, sardonic smile, half-moon reading glasses perched toward the end of his nose, bow tie, square jaw, and remnants of a Montana twang. His idea of a good time was to invite the graduate students and junior faculty over for dinner, unlike her stepfather, who enjoyed a student entourage but considered having them to dinner an extravagance. Drumlin would exhibit an extreme intellectual territoriality, steering the conversation to topics in which he was the acknowledged expert and then swiftly dispatching contrary opinions. After dinner, he would often subject them to a slideshow of Dr. D scuba diving in Cozumel or Tobago or the Great Barrier Reef. He was often smiling into the camera and waving, even in the underwater images. Sometimes there would be a submarine vista of his scientific colleague, Dr. Helga Bork. Drumlin's wife would always object to these particular slides, on the reasonable grounds that most of the audience had already seen them at previous dinner parties. In truth, the audience had already seen all the slides. Drumlin would respond by extolling the virtues of the athletic Dr. Bork, and his wife's humiliation increased. Many of the students gamely went along seeking some novelty they had previously missed among the brain corals and the spiny sea urchins. A few would writhe in embarrassment or become absorbed in the avocado dip. A stimulating afternoon for his graduate students would be for them to be invited over in twos or threes to drive him to the edge of a favorite cliff near Pacific Palisades. Casually attached to his hang glider, he would leap off the precipice toward the tranquil ocean a few hundred feet below. Their job was to drive down the coast road and retrieve him. He would swoop down upon them, beaming exultantly. Others were invited to join him, but few accepted. He had, and delighted in, the competitive advantage. It was quite a performance. Others looked on graduate students as resources for the future, as their intellectual torchbearers to the next generation. But Drumlin, she felt, had quite a different view. For him, graduate students were gunslingers. There was no telling which of them might at any moment challenge him for the reigning title of fastest gun in the West. They were to be kept in their places. He never made a pass at her. But sooner or later, she was certain he was bound to try. In her second year at Caltech, Peter Valerian returned to campus from his sabbatical year abroad. He was a gentle and unprepossessing man. No one, least of all he himself, considered him especially brilliant. Yet he had a steady record of significant accomplishment in radio astronomy, because, he explained when pressed, he kept at it. There was one slightly disreputable aspect of his scientific career. He was fascinated by the possibility of extraterrestrial intelligence. Each faculty member, it seemed, was allowed one foible. Drumlin had hang gliding, and Valerian had life on other worlds. Others had topless bars, or carnivorous plants, or something called transcendental meditation. Valerian had thought about extraterrestrial intelligence, abbreviated ETI, longer and harder, and in many cases more carefully, than anyone else. As she grew to know him better, it seemed that ETI provided a fascination, a romance that was in dramatic contrast with the humdrum business of his personal life. This thinking about extraterrestrial intelligence was not work for him, but play. His imagination soared. Ellie loved to listen to him. It was like entering Wonderland or the Emerald City. Actually, it was better, because at the end of all his ruminations, there was the thought that maybe this could really be true, could really happen. Someday, she mused, there might in fact, and not just in fantasy, be a message received by one of the great radio telescopes. But in a way it was worse, because Valerian, like Drumlin on other subjects, repeatedly stressed that speculation must be confronted with sober physical reality. It was a kind of sieve that separated the rare useful speculation from torrents of nonsense. The extraterrestrials and their technology had to conform strictly to the laws of nature, a fact that severely crimped many a charming prospect. But what emerged from this sieve and survived the most skeptical physical and astronomical analysis might even be true. You couldn't be sure, of course. There were bound to be possibilities that you had missed, that people cleverer than you would one day figure out. Valerian would emphasize how we are trapped by our time and our culture and our biology, how limited we are, by definition, in imagining fundamentally different creatures or civilizations. And separately evolved on very different worlds, they would have to be very different from us. It was possible that beings much more advanced than we might have unimaginable technologies. This was, in fact, almost guaranteed, and even new laws of physics. It was hopelessly narrow-minded, he would say as they walked past a succession of stucco arches, as in a de Chirico painting, to imagine that all significant laws of physics had been discovered at the moment our generation began contemplating the problem. There would be a 21st century physics, and a 22nd century physics, and even a fourth millennium physics. We might be laughably far off in guessing how a very different technical civilization would communicate. But then, he always reassured himself, the extraterrestrials would have to know how backward we were. If we were any more advanced, they would know about us already. Here we were, just beginning to stand up on our two feet, discovering fire last Wednesday, and only yesterday stumbling on Newtonian dynamics, Maxwell's equations, radio telescopes, and hints of super unification of the laws of physics. Valerian was sure they wouldn't make it hard for us. They would try to make it easy. Because if they wanted to communicate with dummies, they would have to make allowances for the dummies. That's why, he thought, he'd have a fighting chance if a message ever came. His lack of brilliance was in fact his strength. He knew, he was confident, what dummies knew. As a topic for her doctoral thesis, Ellie chose, with the concurrence of the faculty, the development of an improvement in the sensitive receivers employed on radio telescopes. It made use of her talents in electronics, freed her from the mainly theoretical Drumlin, and permitted her to continue her discussions with Valerian, but without taking the professionally dangerous step of working with him on extraterrestrial intelligence. It was too speculative a subject for a doctoral dissertation. Her stepfather had taken to denouncing her various interests as unrealistically ambitious, or occasionally as deadeningly trivial. When he heard of her thesis topic through the grapevine, by now she was not talking to him at all. He dismissed it as pedestrian. She was working on the ruby maser. A ruby is made mainly of alumina, which is almost perfectly transparent. The red color derives from a small chromium impurity distributed through the alumina crystal. When a strong magnetic field is impressed on the ruby, the chromium atoms increase their energy, or, as physicists like to say, are raised to an excited state. She loved the image of all the little chromium atoms, called to feverish activity in each amplifier, frenzied in a good practical cause, amplifying a weak radio signal. The stronger the magnetic field, the more excited the chromium atoms became. Thus the maser could be tuned so that it was particularly sensitive to a selected radio frequency. She found a way to make rubies with lanthanide impurities in addition to the chromium atoms, so a maser could be tuned to a narrower frequency range and could detect a much weaker signal than previous masers. Her detector had to be immersed in liquid helium. She then installed her new instrument on one of Caltech's radio telescopes in Owens Valley and detected at entirely new frequencies what astronomers call the 3-degree black body background radiation, the remnant in the radio spectrum of the immense explosion that began this universe. The Big Bang. "Let's see if I've got this right," she would say to herself. "I've taken an inert gas that's in the air, made it into a liquid, put some impurities into a ruby, attached a magnet, and detected the fires of creation." She would then shake her head in amazement. To anyone ignorant of the underlying physics, it might seem the most arrogant and pretentious necromancy. How would you explain this to the best scientists of 1,000 years ago, who knew about air and rubies and lodestones, but not about liquid helium, stimulated emission, and superconducting flux pumps? In fact, she reminded herself, they did not have even the foggiest notion about the radio spectrum, or even the idea of a spectrum, except vaguely from contemplating the rainbow. They did not know that light was waves. How could we hope to understand the science of a civilization 1,000 years ahead of us? It was necessary to make rubies in large batches, because only a few would have the requisite properties. None were quite of gemstone quality, and most were tiny. But she took to wearing a few of the larger remnants. They matched her dark coloring well. Even if it was carefully cut, you could recognize some anomaly in the stone set in a ring or a brooch. The odd way, for example, that it caught the light at certain angles from an abrupt internal reflection, or a peach-colored blemish inside the ruby red. She would explain to non-scientist friends that she liked rubies but couldn't afford them. It was a little like the scientist who first discovered the biochemical pathway of green plant photosynthesis and who forever after wore pine needles or a sprig of parsley in his lapel. Colleagues, their respect for her growing, considered it a minor idiosyncrasy. The great radio telescopes of the world are constructed in remote locations for the same reason Paul Gauguin sailed to Tahiti. For them to work well, they must be far from civilization. As civilian and military radio traffic has increased, radio telescopes have had to hide, sequestered in an obscure valley in Puerto Rico, say, or exiled to a vast scrub desert in New Mexico or Kazakhstan. As radio interference continues to grow, it makes increasing sense to build the telescopes off the Earth altogether. The scientists who work at these isolated observatories tend to be dogged and determined. Spouses abandon them. Children leave home at the first opportunity. But the astronomers stick it out. Rarely do they think of themselves as dreamers. The permanent scientific staff in remote observatories tend to be the practical ones. The experimentalists the experts who know a great deal about antenna design and data analysis, and much less about quasars or pulsars. Generally speaking, they had not longed for the stars in childhood. They had been too busy repairing the carburetor in the family car. After receiving her doctorate, Ellie accepted an appointment as research associate at the Arecibo Observatory, a great bowl 305 meters across, fixed to the floor of a karst valley in the foothills of northwestern Puerto Rico. With the largest radio telescope on the planet, she was eager to employ her maser detector to look at as many different astronomical objects as she could, nearby planets and stars, the center of the galaxy, pulsars and quasars. As a full-time member of the observatory staff, she would be assigned a significant amount of observing time. Access to the great radio telescopes is keenly competitive, there being many more worthwhile research projects than can possibly be accommodated. So reserved telescope time for the resident staff is a perquisite beyond price. For many of the astronomers, it was the only reason they would consent to live in such godforsaken places. She also hoped to examine a few nearby stars for possible signals of intelligent origin. With her detector system, it would be possible to hear the radio leakage from a planet like Earth, even if it was a few light years away. And an advanced society, intending to communicate with us, would doubtless be capable of much greater power transmissions than we were. If Arecibo, used as a radar telescope, was capable of transmitting 1 megawatt of power to a specific locale in space, then a civilization only a little bit in advance of ours might, she thought, be capable of transmitting 100 megawatts or more. If they were intentionally transmitting to the Earth with a telescope as large as Arecibo, but with 100 megawatt transmitter, Arecibo should be able to detect them virtually anywhere in the Milky Way galaxy. When she thought carefully about it, she was surprised that in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, what could be done was so far ahead of what had been done. The resources that had been devoted to this question were trifling, she thought. She was hard-pressed to name a more important scientific problem. The Arecibo facility was known to the locals as El Radar. Its function was generally obscure, but it provided more than 100 badly needed jobs. The indigenous young women were sequestered from the male astronomers, some of whom could be viewed at almost any time of day or night, full of nervous energy, jogging along the circumferential track that surrounded the dish. As a result, the attentions directed at Ellie upon her arrival, while not entirely unwelcome, soon became a distraction from her research. The physical beauty of the place was considerable. At twilight, she would look out the control windows and see storm clouds hovering over the other lip of the valley, just beyond one of the 3 immense pylons from which the feed horns and her newly installed maser system were suspended. At the top of each pylon, a red light would flash to warn off any airplanes that had improbably strayed upon this remote vista. At 4 a.m., she would step outside for a breath of air, and puzzled to understand a massed chorus of thousands of local land frogs called coquilles in imitation of their plaintive cry. Some astronomers lived near the observatory, but the isolation compounded by ignorance of Spanish and inexperience with any other culture tended to drive them and their wives toward loneliness and enemy. Some had decided to live at Ramey Air Force Base, which boasted the only English-language school in the vicinity. But the 90-minute drive also heightened their sense of isolation. Repeated threats by Puerto Rican separatists, convinced erroneously that the observatory played some significant military function, increased the sense of subdued hysteria, of circumstances barely under control. Many months later, Valerian came to visit. Nominally, he was there to give a lecture, but she knew that part of his purpose was to check up on how she was doing and provide some semblance of psychological support. Her research had gone very well. She had discovered what seemed to be a new interstellar molecular cloud complex and had obtained some very fine high time-resolution data on the pulsar at the center of the Crab Nebula. She had even completed the most sensitive search yet performed for signals from a few dozen nearby stars, but with no positive results. There had been one or two suspicious regularities. She observed the stars in question again and could find nothing out of the ordinary. Look at enough stars, and sooner or later terrestrial interference or the concatenation of random noise will produce a pattern that for a moment makes your heart palpitate. You calm down and check it out. If it doesn't repeat itself, you consider it spurious. This discipline was essential if she was to preserve some emotional equilibrium in the face of what she was seeking. She was determined to be as tough-minded as possible, without abandoning the sense of wonder that was driving her in the first place. From her scant supply in the community refrigerator, she had made a rudimentary picnic lunch, and Valerian sat with her along the very periphery of the bowl-shaped dish. Workmen repairing or replacing the panels could be seen in the distance, walking on special snowshoes so they did not tear the aluminum sheets and plunge through to the ground below. Valerian was delighted with her progress. They exchanged bits of gossip and current scientific tidbits. The conversation turned to SETI, as the search for extraterrestrial intelligence was beginning to be called. "Have you ever thought about doing it full-time, Ellie?" he asked. "I haven't thought about it much. But it's not really possible, is it? There's no major facility devoted to SETI full-time anywhere in the world, as far as I know." "No, but there might be. There's a chance that dozens of additional dishes might be added to the very large array and make it into a dedicated SETI observatory. They do some of the usual kind of radio astronomy also, of course. It would be a superb interferometer. It's only a possibility, it's expensive, it needs real political will, and it's years away at best. Well, just something to think about." "Peter, I've just examined some 40-odd nearby stars of roughly solar spectral type. I've looked in the 21-centimeter hydrogen line, which everybody says is the obvious beacon frequency, because hydrogen is the most abundant atom in the universe and so on, and I've done it with the highest sensitivity ever tried. There's not a hint of a signal. Maybe there's no one out there. Maybe the whole business is a waste of time."
"Like life on Venus?" "Oh, that's just disillusionment talking. Venus is a hellhole of a world. It's just one planet."
"But there's hundreds of billions of stars in the galaxy. You've looked at only a handful."
"Wouldn't you say it's a little premature to give up? You've done 1/1,000,000,000th of the problem, probably much less than that if you consider other frequencies."
"I know, I know. But don't you have the sense that if they're anywhere, they're everywhere? If really advanced guys live 1,000 light-years away, shouldn't they have an outpost in our backyard? You could do this SETI thing forever, you know, and never convince yourself that you'd completed the search."
"Ugh, you're beginning to sound like Dave Drumlin. If we can't find them in his lifetime, he's not interested."
"We're just beginning, SETI. You know how many possibilities there are. This is the time to leave every option open. This is the time to be optimistic.
If we lived in any previous time in human history, we could wonder about this all our lives, and we couldn't do a thing to find the answer.
But this time is unique. This is the first time when anybody's been able to look for extraterrestrial intelligence. You've made the detector to look for civilizations on the planets of millions of other stars. Nobody's guaranteeing success. But can you think of a more important question? Imagine them out there sending us signals and nobody on Earth is listening. That would be a joke. A travesty. Wouldn't you be ashamed of your civilization if we were able to listen and didn't have the gumption to do it?" 256 images of the left world swam by on the left. 256 images of the right world glided by on the right. She integrated all 512 images into a wraparound view of her surroundings. She was deep in a forest of great waving blades, some green, some etiolated, almost all larger than she. But she had no difficulty clambering up and over, occasionally balancing precariously on a bent blade, falling to the gentle cushion of horizontal blades below,
and then continuing unerringly on her journey. She could tell she was centered on the trail. It was tantalizingly fresh. She would think nothing, if that's where the trail led, of scaling an obstacle 100 or 1,000 times as tall as she was. She needed no pitons or ropes. She was already equipped. The ground immediately before her was redolent with a marker odor left recently, it must be, by another scout of her clan. It would lead to food. It almost always did. The food would spontaneously appear. Scouts would find it and mark the trail. She and her fellows would bring it back. Sometimes the food was a creature rather like herself. Other times it was only an amorphous or crystalline lump. Occasionally it was so large that many of her clan would be required working together, heaving and shoving it over the folded blades to carry it home. She smacked her mandibles in anticipation. "What worries me the most," she continued, "is the opposite. The possibility that they're not trying. They could communicate with us all right, but they're not doing it because they don't see any point to it. It's like..." She glanced down at the edge of the tablecloth they had spread over the grass. "Like the ants. They occupy the same landscape that we do. They have plenty to do, things to occupy themselves. On some level, they're very well aware of their environment. But we don't try to communicate with them, so I don't think they have the foggiest notion that we exist." A large ant, more enterprising than her fellows, had ventured onto the tablecloth and was briskly marching along the diagonal of one of the red and white squares. Suppressing a small twinge of revulsion, she gingerly flicked it back onto the grass, where it belonged. Chapter 3. White Noise. Heard melodies are sweet, but those unheard are sweeter. John Keats. Ode on a Grecian Urn, 1820. The cruelest lies are often told in silence. Robert Louis Stevenson. Virginibus puerisque, 1881. The pulses had been journeying for years through the great dark between the stars. Occasionally they would intercept an irregular cloud of gas and dust, then a little of the energy would be absorbed or scattered. The remainder continued in the original direction. Ahead of them was a faint yellow glow, slowly increasing in brightness among the other unvarying lights. Now, although to human eyes it would still be a point, it was by far the brightest object in the black sky. The pulses were encountering a horde of giant snowballs. Entering the Argus administration building was a willowy woman in her late 30s. Her eyes, large and set far apart, served to soften the angular bone structure of her face. Her long dark hair was loosely gathered by a tortoise barrette at the nape of her neck. Casually dressed in a knit t-shirt and khaki skirt, she strolled along a hallway on the first floor and entered a door marked E. Arroway, Director. As she removed her thumb from the fingerprint deadlock, an observer might have noticed a ring on her right hand, with an oddly milky red stone unprofessionally set in it. Turning on a desk lamp, she rummaged through a drawer, finally producing a pair of earphones. Briefly illuminated on the wall beside her desk was a quotation from The Parables of Franz Kafka. "Now the sirens have a still more fatal weapon than their song, namely their silence. Someone might possibly have escaped from their singing, but from their silence, certainly never." Extinguishing the light with a wave of her hand, she made for the door in the semi-darkness. In the control room, she quickly reassured herself that all was in order. Through the window, she could see a few of the 131 radio telescopes that stretched for tens of kilometers across the New Mexico scrub desert, like some strange species of mechanical flower straining toward the sky. It was early afternoon, and she had been up late the night before. Radio astronomy can be performed during daylight, because the air does not scatter radio waves from the sun as it does ordinary visible light. To a radio telescope pointing anywhere but very close to the sun, the sky is pitch black, except for the radio sources.
Beyond the Earth's atmosphere, on the other side of the sky, is a universe teeming with radio emission. By studying radio waves, you can learn about planets and stars and galaxies, about the composition of great clouds of organic molecules that drift between the stars, about the origin and evolution and fate of the universe. But all these radio emissions are natural, caused by physical processes. Electrons spiraling in the galactic magnetic field, or interstellar molecules colliding with one another, or the remote echoes of the Big Bang redshifted from gamma rays at the origin of the universe to the tame and chill radio waves that fill all of space in our epoch. In the scant few decades in which humans have pursued radio astronomy, there has never been a real signal from the depths of space. Something manufactured, something artificial, something contrived by an alien mind. There have been false alarms. The regular time variation of the radio emission from quasars and especially pulsars had at first been thought tentatively, tremulously, to be a kind of announcement signal from someone else, or perhaps a radio navigation beacon for exotic ships that plied the spaces between the stars. But they had turned out to be something else. Equally exotic, perhaps, as a signal from beings in the night sky. Quasars seem to be stupendous sources of energy, perhaps connected with massive black holes at the centers of galaxies, many of them observed more than halfway back in time to the origin of the universe. Pulsars are rapidly spinning atomic nuclei, the size of a city. And there had been other rich and mysterious messages that had turned out to be intelligent after a fashion, but not very extraterrestrial. The skies were now peppered with secret military radar systems and radio communication satellites that were beyond the entreaty of a few civilian radio astronomers. Sometimes they were real outlaws, ignoring international telecommunications agreements. There were no recourses and no penalties. Occasionally, all nations denied responsibility. But there had never been a clear-cut alien signal. And yet the origin of life now seemed to be so easy. And there were so many planetary systems, so many worlds, and so many billions of years available for biological evolution that it was hard to believe the galaxy was not teeming with life and intelligence. Project Argus was the largest facility in the world dedicated to the radio search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Radio waves traveled with the speed of light, faster than which nothing, it seemed, could go. They were easy to generate and easy to detect. Even very backward technological civilizations like that on Earth would stumble on radio early in their exploration of the physical world. Even with the rudimentary radio technology available, now only a few decades after the invention of the radio telescope, it was nearly possible to communicate with an identical civilization at the center of the galaxy. But there were so many places in the sky to examine, and so many frequencies on which an alien civilization might be broadcasting, that it required a systematic and patient observing program. Argus had been in full operation for more than 4 years. There had been glitches, bogeys, intimations, false alarms, but no message. "Afternoon, Dr. Arroway." The lone engineer smiled pleasantly at her, and she nodded back. All 131 telescopes of Project Argus were controlled by computers. The system slowly scanned the sky on its own, checking that there were no mechanical or electronic breakdowns, comparing the data from different elements of the array of telescopes. She glanced at the billion-channel analyzer, a bank of electronics covering a whole wall, and at the visual display of the spectrometer. There was not really very much for the astronomers and technicians to do as the telescope array over the years slowly scanned the sky. If it detected something of interest, it would automatically sound an alarm, alerting project scientists in their beds at night if need be. Then Arroway would go into high gear to determine if this one was an instrumental failure or some American or Soviet space bogey. Together with the engineering staff, she would devise ways of improving the sensitivity of the equipment. Was there any pattern? Any regularity in the emission?
She would delegate some of the radio telescopes to examine exotic astronomical objects that had been recently detected by other observatories. She would help staff members and visitors with projects unrelated to SETI. She would fly to Washington to keep interest high at the funding agency, the National Science Foundation. She would give a few public talks on Project Argus at the Rotary Club in Socorro or the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque, and occasionally greet an enterprising reporter who would arrive, sometimes unannounced, in remotest New Mexico. Ellie had to take care that the tedium did not engulf her. Her co-workers were pleasant enough, but even apart from the impropriety of a close personal relationship with a nominal subordinate, she did not find herself tempted into any real intimacies. There had been a few brief, torrid, but fundamentally casual relationships with local men unconnected with the Argus project. In this area of her life, too, a kind of ennui, a lassitude had settled over her. She sat down before one of the consoles and plugged in the earphones. It was futile, she knew. A conceit. To think that she, listening on one or two channels, would detect a pattern when the vast computer system monitoring a billion channels had not. But it gave her a modest illusion of utility. She leaned back, eyes half closed, an almost dreamy expression enveloping the contours of her face. She's really quite lovely, the technician permitted himself to think. She heard, as always, a kind of static, a continuous, echoing random noise. Once, when listening to a part of the sky that included the star AC+793888 in Cassiopeia, she felt she heard a kind of singing, fading tantalizingly in and out, lying just beyond her ability to convince herself that there was something really there. This was the star toward which the Voyager 1 spacecraft, now in the vicinity of the orbit of Neptune, would ultimately travel. The spacecraft carried a golden phonograph record on which were impressed greetings, pictures, and songs from Earth. Could they be sending us their music at the speed of light, while we are sending ours to them only 1/10,000th as fast? At other times, like now, when the static was clearly patternless, she would remind herself of Shannon's famous dictum in information theory, that the most efficiently coded message was indistinguishable from noise unless you had the key to the encoding beforehand. Rapidly, she pressed a few keys on the console before her and played two of the narrow-band frequencies against each other, one in each earphone. Nothing. She listened to the two planes of polarization of the radio waves, and then to the contrast between linear and circular polarization. There were a billion channels to choose from. You could spend your life trying to outguess the computer, listening with pathetically limited human ears and brains, seeking a pattern. Humans are good, she knew, at discerning subtle patterns that are really there, but equally so at imagining them when they are altogether absent. There would be some sequence of pulses, some configuration of the static that would for an instant give a syncopated beat or a brief melody. She switched to a pair of radio telescopes that were listening to a known galactic radio source. She heard a glissando down the radio frequencies, a whistler, due to the scattering of radio waves by electrons in the tenuous interstellar gas between the radio source and the Earth. The more pronounced the glissando, the more electrons were in the way, and the further the source was from the Earth. She had done this so often that she was able, just from hearing a radio whistler for the first time, to make an accurate judgment of its distance. This one, she estimated, was about 1,000 light-years away, far beyond the local neighborhood of stars, but still well within the great Milky Way galaxy. End of Side 2.